Welcome to Foundation, a podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 2, Episode 8, The Last Empress. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
Man, I really messed myself up because, as you'll recall, on the last podcast, I vowed as soon as we finished our business date, I was going to fly to my TV and watch the next episode, which, because of our schedule, made it a two-week gap before I can watch the next episode that's going to end today. This is even the worst one to end, because, like, I was just reeling. Like, it was going into, like, what it felt like a Scooby-Doo kind of direction with, like, Dusk and Rue going down into the tunnels with, into the Demerzel dungeon or whatever the hell it is. And I'm like, ah, and then it just, and Cleon the First comes out and starts, the whole Telling Bomb going to jack Gale's bot. There's just a lot of stuff going on here. It's all terribly exciting. And it's like in the middle of it. I feel like this is a terrible episode to stop and be like, what do you think? Because, like, we're just in the middle of everything.
Yeah, we don't have all the information, certainly, that I want. It's another one of those episodes that's just like, click next, let's go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't. It's for 2 weeks of it, so a larger than average wait, it's been excruciating. What did you think?
Oh yeah, same here. I'm desperate to see the next episode, because I want answers to, you know, who's the prison for, those kind of things. They've done a great job of making Telem a character I really hate. Every single episode I've seen with her has made her less and less sympathetic, and more of a villain. And I think it's too late to walk that stuff back. So that's apparently what they intended. So good job there. I really hate her. But yeah, this Cleon the First stuff that we're finally, like, starting to get to, the Demerzel stuff, it's episode 8 of a season. It's about time to, like, really hit us with some revelations. And it seems like they're warming that up.
Yeah, the way they're kind of like inverting some themes, and layering and, you know, contrasting. Like, for example, I was thinking of Telem's big speech about how, oh, we feel all the suffering that we cause, and that makes us do only what's required. And it's like, I was thinking when, you know, she also is talking about how when she first jacked the little child's body, you know, pushed her mind aside, made room for herself, how that the little girl, she could hear her faintly for years, like she's down in a well. And I'm like, that doesn't seem like someone who's really opening themselves up to feeling someone else's suffering.
Nope.
And another way to describe a person who opens themselves to all kinds of extreme suffering is desensitized. Like, the first time, you know, you're a soldier and you see someone's brains blown out in front of you, well, I imagine every single time it's shocking, but, like, there's some people who just, like, push through and whatever, are able to shove down whatever is, you know, core of their humanity and continue to do the job they have to do. And I just kept on thinking about that. It's like, are you just full of shit? Like, have you exposed yourself? So now it's like you just, like you're desensitized to the suffering, especially people like Telem, who's had several lifetimes to get calloused and desensitized towards suffering of sentient creatures. This is an example of things I'm like, man, you go back and revisit some of the things they've been saying and how they've kind of been turned on their head. And yeah, it's like I said, like, I've been trying to see her as a Magneto figure. And you still can. Like I said, it's like she's come by all this cruelty, honestly. But but it's also, I feel like they maybe zigged that too, that, like, she had a life of privilege. Although I guess it was a shit life too.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, it's just torture in some way, but
There's a lot of thinking to do in an episode like this.
Yeah, for sure.
In a season like this.
No, it's exciting. I was apparently wrong. I mean, look, my prediction was pretty tongue-in-cheek, let's be honest. But Constant and Hober, how'd you enjoy that scene?
Oh, I mean, it's Kanzen is single-minded. Like, the second that she is clinging on to her Haslan's pyramid of needs by a fingernail, she's like, let's get it on. Yeah. It's cute. I don't know what to make of Hobart being so intimidated by her. Like,
is he intimidated? I feel like the situation is just strange. Her demeanor here is weird. He's probably never had a woman come at him like this, right?
Really? I feel like this is so many thousands of years in the future that surely some of those gender dynamics would have broken down by now. You got the Sadie Hawkins style of like just going and expressing sexual interest in somebody.
Yeah, but it's the transactional nature of it. Not like they're trading something here, but her just getting right into it and the efficiency of it, right, as they call it. Like, it's very efficient. That's the off-putting thing. That's the thing that puts him on his back foot.
Or there's something that's like just completely there's an unpretentious quality to it. You know, there is no like you said, that's not someone that a person who's, I guess, what am I trying to say here? It's not something a person that's like putting passion first would say. It's like, certainly, well, not. I decided about stripping down naked or kissing, and I thought that the stripping down naked would be the most efficient. It's like, there is something.
Yeah, it's weird. It's really weird.
Yeah, it's like very earnest and straightforward and almost industrious. About it. It's good. It's good. They, like I said, they have a lot of chemistry. I thought that's
my
shipping heart is satisfied.
Sure. Gotcha.
I'm trying to think. But yeah, there's just so much stuff going on, and we've got so much just in general of things that are going on that, you know, it's like we didn't really revisit Belle just a little bit. No new news on the spacer front. Like, there's this show is now can afford to like have balls that they toss up in the air and don't get back to for an episode or two because they got so many other fascinating things to do.
Yeah, and this one might like crack the whole plan wide open again. You know, Harry finds out maybe too much, the Vault Harry, in this episode. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I'm excited to see it.
That's the fun thing. I think that they've captured what I remember being one of the fun parts of the book, is like, how in the hell can psychohistory possibly account for this? And I'm not sure if they're going to eventually subvert it. Like, because that's the thing. It's like, I could see them eventually subverting that, the complementing it, supplementing it, addending it. But it's just, I just think it's really interesting to see the show kind of like grapple with those things. It's like, well, if this was the countermeasure that was supposed to be stealth, the unseen hand, you know, the right hand that the left doesn't see, and now the left sees it and it even has a thumb that can put on the scales. I mean, how many inversions and flips and corkscrews did the Harry account for, or did psychohistory account for?
I don't know. We'll see. That's part of what's so exciting about it.
Yeah. And you know, it turns out they did. It feels like, obviously, they didn't kill Salvor. Feel like Harry, yeah, though, the physical copy of Harry, the flesh and blood, that body's dead.
Seems like it, yeah.
Although there's nothing saying that Telem Bonn couldn't have, this is all just still a mental image, and she's got Harry locked away in some kind of stasis prison for.
I mean, we could sit down for the next four seasons and say that, you know, that way lies madness. I
guess
don't know
why
that I want
would
to go down
she?
That road.
If some fans of me, this crazy theory, I'd be like, okay, so why would Telem Bonn do that, right? And I can't come up with a reason, because in her mind, the only reason she's trying to shield Gale and Salva from any of these realities is to make Gal more pliable so she can jack her mind and her body. And once she does that, she doesn't give a shit about what any of either of the women think. So
yeah, and I would say, why would she do that? But there's this nagging feeling that of the thing they do in this episode where they're like, they kill, you know, quote unquote, Salvor at the end of last episode, and then we find out only in this episode that, you know, Sighted don't kill Sighted. And I think you have to throw that out the fucking window by the end of the episode, but we'll talk about that. But that's what I mean. Like, they could come in with some reasoning why she wouldn't kill Harry later, but it feels to me like Harry's dead.
And I also really like how, just like, you know, there's possible things that Harry couldn't predict about the plan. There's clearly things that Tellum is relying on in terms of her, the absolute loyalty of her people, that's already being tested, because, you know, Salver and Gaylord is likable people. And I think she's preached a certain way of living and doing, and they're seeing how maybe that only applies to some of them, and there's others that can just are allowed to break the rules. I'm sure a lot of them agree with it. Like, well, Tellum saved us all. We need to keep Tellum around. Sure. But the Spoon Kid, the kid that was running around masquerading as Hugo, I do wonder about, you know, if they're going to be, if there's going to be a fraction in the Mentallics and who they support.
Yeah, we'll see. I hope so, because, man, it's hard to support Tellum at the moment.
Yeah. Got a fantastic feedback theory for the at the end of the show, too, that I'm really excited. Something's kind of like, I feel, it was one of those things where I slapped my head when I read it. I'm like, why didn't I think of that? So...
Nice. All right, well, let's get into the recap.
Let's do it. All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Math is never just numbers, and this isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation.
We start off with Rue sneaking into Dimmerzell's chambers to snoop around. She is found by Brother Dusk, and she asks some questions about Dimmerzell's origin and purpose. And then out by the mural, she asks about the robot wars. And all Dust can think of whenever he tries to remember Demerzel's role in the Empire is this line, "She will always be here as she has always been, or always has been." And Rue says, "Hey, Dominion can restore those memories if you're having trouble accessing them." And Dust notices the chroma on the mural isn't moving the way it should, but he's called away in the moment for the execution of Polly and Constant.
Yeah, what'd you think of his Howard Hughes Wave of the Future moment where he like tries to recall certain things and just comes up with one little pithy phrase?
I don't recognize that reference, but...
You know, like, isn't that the last scene of Aviator where you think Howard Hughes is like beat his mental illness and then he's talking about something being the Wave of the Future and he's locks in the Wave of the Future? It's the Way of the Future, rather.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's interesting to see Dusk react to this line because it's not the conjuring of that line that puts him off. It's the repetition of that line, right? So if he were to think of Demerzel outside of the context of someone prodding him about Demerzel, the line would come up and he would move on and he wouldn't realize that his memories have been specifically perhaps altered. But when he's confronted with it over and over and all that he can come up with is this one line, it starts to sink in what's happened here.
So that's my question. Are we supposed to notice this discrepancy between Rue's claimed experience of memory loss, where it's like you're not even aware that there's a hole there, versus this definitely feels like a cavity filled with cotton that he's aware of? Like he didn't know it was there before, but now that he's mm-hmm. discovered it, it's like something he's very much noticing.
Yeah.
Is there a discrepancy there? Is it more of just like...
I don't think there's a discrepancy. I think, like I tried to explain it, it's something that in passing would just kind of roll off your brain. But when it's specifically pointed to and you say, "What is this? Why can't you think of this?" Then it becomes the cotton wad.
If someone asked Rue back on her home planet, so like, "Come on, just between us girls, what was the third position you and the Emperor took?" And she'd just be like... "I had a pleasant time at the Gossamer Court." I'm not saying it is a possible contradiction. It's just on my crazy red yarn theory board is like seeing that as like this is something that's slightly different than what we heard before. Also, Rue could be lying. Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible that like, yeah, it's pretty obvious that you have missing memories, and she's just saying that's the old man because obviously they're trying to manipulate every level of the genetic dynasty. So
for sure, and I think there are really good attempts at that here. When she's saying Cloud Dominion can restore those memories, she's giving up a lot of information. This is
she's going real fast.
For good reason, right? I mean, she sees the moves that Sarath is making and she's extremely worried because she thinks she's making mistakes. And so she might be trying to back channel this whole thing a little bit quicker.
Is that what that is? Because I was thinking that like there's a little hypocrisy to her like tone of caution because throwing caution to the wind, and it's like she's annoyed at herself as she's annoyed at Sarath. But
that could be it. Or she could be propelled by Sarath's daring, I guess.
Any ideas of where they're going with the soul system? Like they've now called, like this is the third step of the Martin reveal, but like I still don't know.
I mean, I assume it has to do with the robot wars and the origins of Demerzel, but we'll see,
But what is the importance of, is the robot wars what destroyed the soul system, where humanity had to find a new home? Is like the final thing that killed the crate, is it still out there? It's interesting that they actually drew attention to it, and then it's just almost like, when he said, "I know that," on the tool chest, those eight planets... I'm like, oh, he's going to start talking about the soul system. But no, it just took it back. It's the same one. It's on this fucking mural. And I'm like, ah. So it's like.
Yeah, we know, dude. We know.
Yeah. Yeah. If you missed a pre-production design, they're calling attention to it. But I still don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. But this idea that his memories are gone is like super interesting to Dusk, right? He's been worried about that. And now he basically has confirmation of it. And she Rue is offering a solution to that, I think he's going to be inclined to really hear her out on that. Assuming, you know, that they're not both in a prison created by Cleon the First at the end of this episode. True. I don't know.
True. It's also funny, there's also this other stuff where, like, Dusk is, like, wounded that she lied to him about the memories. Like, I thought we trusted each other. She's like, no, you thought I trusted you. And I thought that's a nice mirror of the brothers' relationship where they're wounded. To, like, how dare you memory audit us? Like, don't you trust? We trust each other. It's like, no. It's I feel like there's a lot of things that are drawing attention, unwise assumptions that people are making about their station in life, about their supremacy of technology, about, you know, their faith in a system to keep him working, and those being proven to be, like, false. Like, these things that seem so sure and so dependable are not really.
Yeah, I do wonder how far that extends. What happens when Day thinks about Demerzel's origins? Does Day also conjure the line, she's always been here as she always will be? Or does he have extra knowledge temporarily while he's Day?
I could buy that, but my current operating theory is that the Cleonic dynasty is actually Demerzel.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just using human puppets so that the galaxy at large doesn't freak the fuck out that a robot is actually ruling them. I think that her and Cleon made that deal. Like, he's like, we suck, we're shit, we should have never wiped you guys out, I'm putting all of our faith in humanity, I can see that this is all going to collapse, and I'm going to put all my faith into you, Demerzel, who is yet to betray humanity over your 13,000 years of reasons to do so. I feel like that's the big okey-doke. And they're all memory manipulated to not realize that.
That makes a lot of sense, for sure.
Except, what's the one thing that doesn't fit into that?
Oh, well, I was going to say, we only see the memory alteration stuff through the two versions of Cleon that we know are memory altered, right? We don't see any confirmation about Day's memory state. It's only Dawn and Dusk. Dawn's the one who realizes we're puppets. Dusk is the one who can't remember anything about Demerzel.
And or maybe the Day gets, like, there's memories that are unblocked to the primary that then reblocked. Yeah, and they're bequeathed to you when you become Day, and they're taken from you when you become Dusk. I'd buy that, except for these Cleons just seem so ineffective in the last few generations, and they're trusting Demerzel. It's like, The big question, the thing that I don't feel like fits the theory, is why is Demerzel trying to move away from the genetic dynasty? Because that would very much complicate things. But I don't know, because, like, she seems like she's really uneasy about Day going to Foundation. And not for, like, oh, he's in mortal jeopardy. It's more of, like, she seems like she's very concerned about this course of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell how on board she even is with this marriage thing, or if she has a backup plan to make sure it doesn't go through. If she's just, you know, she's still got everything under control vaguely, but
is that the plan? That, like, well, Sereth is going to die in some kind of crazy attack, and it's going to make the Cleons even more dependent upon me because you shot your shot, and it all ended up in tears, and you just got to come back and trust. Trust Mama Demerzel, because she always knows what's best. She's always been... Yeah, I feels like that's what they're going, especially with Cleon coming out and being like, oh, you want answers? I got your answers, fucker, at the end.
Maybe she's trying to consolidate power. I mean, they make the whole point in this episode, like, you know, an empress is still an empress, whether, you know, the emperor is dead or alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other way would be true as well. The king of Cloud Dominion would still be king whether the queen is dead or not. And I wonder if this is Demerzel's attempt to bolster empire by usurping the power of Cloud Dominion. Because they see that empire
you marry her and then kill Sereth, and then he's owns the de facto everything by right. Interesting. Yeah, that's...
Because that would go both ways.
And that's not a threat to her plan, because that's just her putting, you know, trying to keep the Empire going as long as possible. Him going and talking to Harry and the Foundation is like something off her spiral.
Want him to die. Yeah.
I don't know,
man. That's why I want to hit the play button on the next episode. But
I know, dude.
I can't.
And I'm gonna do it. I should only be a week wait. But we're in the same torment as you. We're just time shifted a week into the future.
I want to talk about a tech thing real quick. The Shadowmaster silencer.
The AKA Goyer smacking us about with the thing that we missed earlier in the season.
Yeah. I think that's cool. The idea that you can sort of. I imagine it works on the same principle as noise canceling headphones or those discs, those psychic discs in the prison later in the episode, where it just cancels out the noise pattern so you can't hear it of every movement you make.
Of course, with technology sufficient in advance, magic, blah, blah, blah. Sure. I do wonder if there's countermeasures. Are there ways, like, you know, if you know anything about like Cold War espionage, like, wouldn't be the first nation state that thought they had an uncrackable code. An unbreakable cone of silence that actually everybody, you know, was reading behind their back. So I don't know. Probably not. But
there's a lot of fingers pointing, you know, at Rue as the one who organized the assassination, right? There's always the, like, why would I do that? I want
Day,
Cloud
right?
Dominion.
Of Day.
Okay, the assassination attempt of Day, yeah.
Okay. Because I don't think anyone suggested that. That this was, I think the idea that this is a Sereth plot, the original assassination to kill her family, that's the, we've left all that behind. Okay.
No. The attempted assassination of Day. She's got these Shadowmaster silencers. She remembers the servants' byways from her time in the palace that she wasn't supposed to remember. There's a lot of fingers there pointing at her.
And they executed the Shadowmaster right off the bat under suspicion. Like, I wonder if maybe they did turn him.
It's possible. I mean, they pretty easily turned one of his other guard with just an offer of money and getting away from Empire.
Yeah, it's just another reflection of how weak the Empire is getting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're over-relying on, speaking of technology, they're, you know, like, the Empire seems to be very much over-relying on the fact that they think they have ultimate mastery over people's memories.
Yeah.
Which is a handy trick for an authoritarian regime, let me tell you.
Yeah, and if Dusk weren't so, like, interested in the prospect of renewing his own memory, he would probably be a lot more disconcerted by the fact that they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go over to Ignis, where Gail asks where Harry is. Tellum says she killed him, and that Gail already knew that. Gail asks why and demands to see Salvor. Tellum says that's not possible because you're not really here. And Gail wakes in a cave prison designed to break her mind and find the location of the Prime Radiant. I think that's what they're trying to do here, but then they just pull her out of that later and transfer her body. So it might have something to do with the body, the mind transfer.
They're trying to break her, or they're trying to soften her mind up so she can, because, like, there must be some, especially as someone as powerful as Gale, it must be a little bit more than just picking a lock to get inside their brains. It's like they're marinating her mind meat.
And then once she gets inside her brain, it'll be easier to find the Prime Radiant, I assume. But
I'd assume it'd be, it'd be trivial at that point.
Mm-hmm. There's some completely fucked up stuff here, and it's just a prelude to the even more fucked up stuff that is going to happen later. But when she tells Gail why she killed Harry, it's completely fucked, man. She says, "You cared for him. I saw that you cared for him, so I killed him."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, lady, you are now the villain.
She's also on an accelerated timeline, okay? She's got the space cancer, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, maybe she could do something kinder if she had the time, but, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The grand sweep of the galaxy, a couple hundred years of lifetimes. What's one Harry Seldon against that?
Yeah, one genius's life against that.
This also, because, you know, it's also making sense because there's been a few scenes where we're like, what the fuck was that, like, when Gale had that spontaneous, like, drowning vision? That's when Harry was dying. And there was another instance where what was something we didn't understand. We had that question about, like, you know, why did Brother Constant say, like, oh, this reminds me of when I came back the first time. And Polly's like, what? And she's like, oh, nothing. Well, that was a clue that Harry was inside her, because she had never been. So there's been, it's interesting to go back, and I imagine the season will reward this a lot, as interwoven as the stuff I'm just getting on my first go through. But I bet they do that. I bet they're doing that a lot.
They are. I listened to the latest official Foundation podcast.
I literally finished it 5 minutes before we got on the horn today.
There's so much stuff in there where he says, oh, yeah, and this is a seed we planted, and this, and I'm just like slapping my forehead. I missed that completely, and I wish I had that information when talking about it, because it makes it so much more interesting.
Yep. Official podcast, pretty good.
It is. Josiah, the little kid.
You only had to listen to one Foundation podcast. Probably make it that one.
I don't know. I recommend it, but maybe not that strongly. Josiah, the little kid cited, sees Tellum coughing in this scene. And I'm not sure where I stand on what I think he thinks about Tellum. Because he seems to be helping out Salvor. He feels bad about how she's being treated. Gives her quite a bit of information here. More than Tellum would want him to, certainly. He might be the thing that steps in between her plan and getting Gale.
That's exactly what I was thinking, too. He's like, there's something about also the fact that he's relatively innocent and naive. Like, he might believe the kumbaya shit that some of the older, you know, maybe more cynical mentalics don't quite, or have outgrown, or kind of like, you know,
the ones who are able to do the mental gymnastics to justify Tellum's actions. You know, kids have a knack for cutting through bullshit a lot of the time, and there's a lot of bullshit flying around.
Yeah. And I wonder how much, because they talk about how open things are, but I do wonder how many of the mentalics understand, like, what the table means. Like, when that kid says it's a great honor, does he understand what's going to happen? Or is this something that, like, right. A vast, you know, maybe, you know, any mentalic that's old, younger than 50 has no idea that this is her deal. This is her whole deal.
Yeah.
But maybe they do, because, I mean, maybe I take her at her word that everything she said about her pre-life is true, that the parents of the little girl considered a great honor, et cetera, et cetera. Et cetera. So it's like, it's all kinds of fucked up ways you can look at child sacrifice culturally, I suppose, but.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know if he's going to be instrumental in breaking up the ceremony, because there's the much more obvious thing of Salvor out there with a belt full of mind and rock breaking rings. I assume she's going to come flying Kool-Aid Manning through the wall, literally, and break up this thing. But we'll see.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go over to Terminus, where Foundation watches the live-streamed execution of Polly and Constant on Trantor. We see Day choosing to kill Constant first, but as she's praying, Hober's ship jumps into the scene right next to the execution platform. He manages to get Constant back to the ship, but Becky's killed in action, and Polly's still a prisoner. And Hober takes off Constant's collar, and they jump away hand in hand.
I tell you, this show's got a thing for one-off intriguing sci-fi design. These collars of Typhus. Damn. Just iris your head right off.
Yeah.
It's like a cigar cutter.
Oh, yeah. Why not? I mean, that's cool. If you're gonna have executions, make them cool. That's what I say. Make them a spectacle. And this is a fucking spectacle. This whole scene, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hober jumping in. Just the grandiose nature of this execution being broad beamed to the galaxy.
Galactic, and then Hober just like stares right at the camera and big, sorry, knocking your shit over, dude.
And as far as statements go, holy shit, this couldn't be a bigger statement. Empire can be touched. It's what Glaewyn says later, right?
I mean, I'd say it feels like the Imperial 9/11, except for we had that last year with the space elevator. So, mm-hmm. like, this is just a continuation of the decline that, you know...
This strikes at the heart of Empire. This is Empire itself, you know?
And it's not... This wasn't, like, a dedicated terrorist attack where someone had to suicide bomb this, that, and the other. This, someone just drove their pickup truck into the inner sanctum of mm-hmm. the Empire, did a yard job, and stole a political prisoner. And there was nothing they could do to stop it.
That's the thing. Yeah, reclaiming one of the prisoners who's set to be executed is a huge blow to the image of Empire. It's something that happens on planet as opposed to something that happened off planet. You know, the elevator is very close to the planet, but that's an easier access, whereas you are striking at the heart, the Cleon of it mm-hmm. all, right? You're getting mm-hmm. within feet of the Empire itself. It's a huge blow.
Oh, yeah. And why do you think the Emperor didn't force Sereth to choose? Do you think it's like one of those things where it's like it would embarrass him in public?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because when he puts it to her, I'm like, oh, I see what he's doing here. You know, he's trying to force her into being complicit in this act that is going to turn the people kind of against her. Like, executions are violent. Yeah, it's a possible lead into that. But when he lets up on that, it's the same question I had about Dimmerzel last episode. Why didn't she force the examination of her womb, right? All these tests that they're supposed to
do. That makes sense because she still thought that Day valued Sereth's consent and, you know, personage.
And she didn't want Sereth blowing up her spot about being a robot, all this kind of stuff. Like, that made a little more sense. This, I'm genuinely curious. I don't quite understand why he doesn't force it here. But
it's just like a threat. Because, like, the thing is, like, if she just, like, balks or does anything but enthusiastically says, off with her head, you know, he looks like a fucking fool. So it's one of those things where it's, like, it's a little bit of, like, supposed to make her get that scary feeling in the pit of your stomach like you're falling. But it just, like, it's something just light, mm-hmm. like, to fuck with her. I don't know, because the thing is this stuff, I will say this does plant Day as kind of a big dumb, but I already kind of knew that. I almost asked like Goya that as a question. It's like, are you guys writing Day to deliberately seem stupid? Not just in his terms of his actions, but I've even found his speechifying is extremely vulgar. Not in like a profane way, although it's that too, but in just like a very coarse common. You know, he's talking like a not particularly bright Fortune 500 CEO.
Yeah, it's incredible, like, if you go back.
He's on a Fortune 498. He's just hanging on there by his nails.
Sure. Yeah. I went back to look up some things specifically for this episode to season one, and you can see how different they are in their mannerisms and their behavior and their speech, too.
Yeah,
it's definitely degrading.
So what is the point of this from Harry's perspective? I couldn't help but notice it's a real moment for the Foundation to see one of their prophets there kneeling, about to be executed by the Empire. Is Harry trying to stiffen the Foundation's backbone so they absolutely go to war? Because I could see, like, okay, what if Day went to Foundation and sues for peace, and the administrator is kind of like a weak person. Harry kind of sees it, and he needs the Foundation to go to war, so he's doing this to just make sure he puts a little bit extra steel in the spine of that administrator and the people on Terminus. How do you see
it's possible
this outworking for the benefit of psychohistory?
I mean, that's the thing. I would say it's to drive them into war, but it doesn't, right? I wonder if it's something where we need to see what's going to happen with Day over on Terminus to really understand what he's doing. I can't quite put my finger on it.
You know, they say that individuals don't matter in psychohistory, but I got to say, where would we be without Becky?
Yeah.
Where would we be without Becky?
she saves the day here. Definitely. Again.
The face that Lee Pace makes the second Becky sinks her teeth in his shoulder, I got a screen capture of it. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Yeah. Just him frantically running, or there's a little Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean kind of thing into his prancing and fleeing and there's a comedic aspect to it I think he's tapping into that I quite enjoyed. Unfortunately, Becky, I guess she's too expensive to animate for what I got from the podcast, and they had to kill her and throw her off the balcony here.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I kind of wanted her to kill Day, because, I mean, talk about striking a blow against Empire, like killing one of the clones. Like, sure, they decant another, but it's even more of a statement, and I wonder why they didn't go with that.
Speaking of inversions, I thought it was really interesting that, you know, we've seen Day on top of Demerzel. And in this instance where his aura fails and she has to like get on top of him to like shield his body with hers, so that puts him in this very emasculating position where he's like, get the fuck off me. That is an interesting inversion.
Yeah. I have some questions around that too.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get into here in another
who
scene.
Here's a question. 'Cause I don't think it's an option. The underlying question is no longer a question. Who is sabotaging the Imperial technology? How many there times we have we seen an aura fail, nanite bots not working, security cams failing, records be? Who the fuck is sabotaging the? It's got to be Demerzel, right? It's got to be.
Seems like it's got to be Demerzel. She feels like the only one with access enough to do it.
But why would she, is it possible that she's literally a double agent? Like there is a Day Demerzel that wakes and interfaces with Day and Dusk and Dawn, and then there's the nighttime Demerzel, which kind of actually is there like a Mother Darkness that she becomes where she's doing the will of Cleon the First?
Sure.
And that like these two things are at odds of each other?
Why does that feel like a bridge too far in a show that has done crazier things?
Well, I guess to make it not crazy, you just feel like there's actually no demarcation. She knows she's herself the whole time. It's just that she's doing things behind the scene to undermine the Cleons.
Mm-hmm.
But why? But the reason I went with the separation is like, why disable his aura and then shield him with your body?
Keep up appearances, perhaps.
Is a bonus if he dies in the attack, but if he does, but then you just decant. I'm not sure. I don't know how to explain that.
Yeah, I mean, so what? This one dies. I don't know, man. It's definitely a huge question I had after I realized the nanobots weren't working in a timely fashion either.
If the aura breaks, the nanites break. What if the real time memory transfers? Wouldn't it be a shame if like you just can't decant the clone? You know.
Yeah.
These are all foundational.
Where Demerzel, you know, if something were to happen to these Cleons all at once, perhaps, then something might happen to the clones. You know, It turns out, you know, the Emperors all died, and the clone stuff didn't work either. Shit, I guess we have no Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think
she can just she can't just rule herself. That's she's got to have a way to have somebody to work if this theory is even true.
Mm-hmm.
But did you have a problem with how easy Hober got away? Like, I get that you can jump in because they don't understand that, but he just goes to orbit. Yeah. Are there no weapons in those giant orbital rings that Cleon's always talking about being chains and collars? And mm-hmm. does like Trantor have no defenses other than its fleet?
Seems like that's possible, but I don't know why that
was it
true.
Another security failure.
Yeah, it can be a security failure. I mean, I feel like it's a non-starter as far as like theorizing goes, because he could have literally just jumped away from where he was. Right, he doesn't need to be in orbit. He doesn't need to be anywhere. He can just jump.
But that's
why
that's
space.
Another thing. They could have neatly dodged all those, but like they didn't. So,
yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I talked about Bel Rios and Glaewyn sort of reacting to seeing this And Claywin says Hober proved the Empire can be touched. I think that definitely proves that. And, you know, we talked about the space elevator falling. That was over 100 years ago. I think a lot of people may have forgotten about that event at this point and now view Empire as untouchable again. So this kind of reproves the point.
Yeah, you got several generations between them and now and then. I'm certain that's the case. I do wonder, because I think you're supposed to be asking yourself, like, what is the potential for Bel Rios to join a rebellion or to join with Foundation?
100%, yeah.
How much do you think the potimeter's adjusted for that course of action?
I think it's moving more towards rebellion. Or at least, if not open rebellion from Bel, he could do things that would contribute to the downfall of the Empire behind the scenes.
He'd just stand aside, or...
Sure. I mean, he's...
Broker a deal with the... Sounds like he has a really tight relationship with the Spacers, like not a lot of humans do. Like, She Who Shines Brightly, or I forget what the name of the Spacer to support his capital ship.
She bends light,
yes.
Yeah.
She Who Sent Her is her mother. I think there's it seems like they don't have very good relations with normal humans, and they took great pains to show that Bel Rios does enjoy good relations with his spacer. So it's like, it'd be an interesting power broker.
And now you've coupled him up with the quote unquote thorn in the side, or the Hober Mallow who will pierce the side of the Empire, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the action she's talking about when she says he'll pierce the side of Empire, or if there's more to come, but I could see Hober and Bel being a pretty interesting combination.
Yeah.
And they're now in proximity to each other, so.
And they admire, like, you can't help but think that Bel admires Hober, his, like, dash and daring and, you know, style, panache.
Yeah, I assume that... Well, we see why Harry wanted Hober, but I assume the benefit of having Hober here is that he's the only one stupid enough to do this. Because, man, it's risky. So everybody's taken back to the palace. Dusk says they have to retaliate. And Day says, I'm going to go to Terminus to talk to Foundation. And he's going to take Polly with him. Nobody except for Sarath thinks this is a good idea. So Day leaves Tranter in Dawn's hands.
Is Day an idiot? Do you think Day actually is touched by Sarath, his backing, or is he just playing? Is he assumed that she's playing the public part, so he's going to do the same? But it's a weird public part to play in their inner sanctum. I think Day's just this dumb.
Really? I think Day's got his mindset, and he might not care what Sarath thinks here. Because, look, as a viewer, I see this as a naked attempt to get him killed. Like if he goes off and does this thing, he's gonna get killed. They're gonna decamp maybe a better clone. I don't know.
Well, he's still stupid. You're not explaining the situation where Day's not stupid. You're just saying, here's the other depth of the unfathomable stupidity you haven't considered. So it's like, okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, Day is definitely not the brightest bulb. Going to the Foundation personally is. I guess when you're a clone entity, it's not as crazy as if you weren't. But
that's actually one of the first smart thing he's done. You know, like, let's try talking. What could it hurt? If they annihilate us anyway, then we talk before they annihilate us. We annihilate them and take everyone and we talk. But what? Yeah, what
sure. The I don't know, man. It doesn't seem also, like there's any hope of it working.
Oh, I agree with that. But it's also, I'm like, from his, it's also a rejection of his brother's philosophy of, like, sit back on Trantor and let Demerzel handle everything.
So that one of the things I noticed in this scene is he leaves Trantor to Dawn when he takes off to go to Terminus. That's a change from what he's done previously, and I assumed it was protocol to leave the planet to Dusk. He did this when he went to visit the Luminous in season one. He left it specifically to Dusk. That makes sense. He's got the experience to run the Empire while he's gone. To leave it to Dawn is a slap in the face to Dusk, an intentional one, I think, just to spite him.
Yeah, showing that, you know,
don't disagree with me.
It's a rejection of his seeming lazy and disinterested. And he's like being punished, like, oh, you know, yeah, you had your thumb up your ass the entire time I was coming up, and now you want to be like, oh, it's an act of war, an act of... No, fuck you. Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely being sat down.
Yeah, for sure. We kind of already talked about the aura stuff not working. We could go here to Rue and Sereth in private. Rue tells Sereth that she can't get romantically entangled with Brother Dawn and reminds her what's at stake if Day finds out. And Sereth says, I am queen and I will make the choices. Anybody who has to resort to saying, I am queen to win an argument has lost that argument.
Yeah. Yeah. But on the other hand, I think there is a little bit of Rue not taking her own advice and trying to call, you know, and her queen, who, that's the thing, is like, Sereth is not Joffrey. It's also, I think, it's fine to remind, you know, especially if you're a young person who's thrust in this position, your senior advisors, who actually is the boss from time to time. Mm-hmm. But, but I think Rue's point out, it's like, you know, you think you've lost everything, but there is so much more for you to lose. And in terms of like the Dominion, you know, the people, our world, our home, like we could lose it all.
I mean, when she's saying that, I'm thinking back to the previous scene with the previous season with Day taking Dawn's love interest out to, you know, the garden and killing everyone who's ever known her.
Yeah.
With the twist of a wrist.
Wiping off Thespin and Acreon from, you know, like just destroying the planet, their planets entirely. It can get pretty fucking biblical. Empire's retribution.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's going to be made way more explicit later in the episode. But as soon as I saw the situation, I was like, well, that's a terrible idea to leave Sereth alone on this planet with Dawn in charge.
Yeah.
Because exactly what happens is going to happen.
You mentioned like the wife and widow being are both empresses. I wonder if that connects to Demerzel as well. Like someone asked us in feedback last week, do we think that Demerzel could be the queen, Gwendolyn or whatever the hell Cleon's mother was? And I was like, I can't see how that could literally be true.
Yeah.
But also, like, I guess she could, there's nothing says, you know, she could just change her appearance or whatnot. So,
she hasn't for 130 plus years, which I guess is,
but she's been,
roughly
she's had
the
a job
in a human lifetime, but also
she's had a job that had, yeah. I do wonder, and I wonder if like, cause you know, one of the things that's made it particularly hard to not watch the next episode is that, Goyer said that like, you know, next episode was going to be a big answer for Demerzel type episode. And yeah, obviously they're going down into the Demerzel dungeon. We're going to get some answers, but
yeah.
Yeah. Her being a robot 13,000 years old makes the possibilities like she could be a completely different person.
Our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Mm-hmm. try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
The algorithm says this podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation. Let's go over to Ignis, where Josiah gives a very much alive Salvor some food. Surprise, surprise. She tries to use her coin to perceive Gale's fate, but it doesn't work because of these discs that are repressing her or suppressing her abilities. Gale does some Prime Radiant slash mental magic. I honestly couldn't tell you how she gets the Prime Radiant here, but she does, and she goes over. She uses it to transfer her mind to the vault where...
Wait, Salvor didn't she realize that the thing was hidden in her coat?
Maybe, but I don't understand why she picked up what looks like a fucking cup holder. Like, why was that in her coat?
That's the full unfolded Prime Radiant.
Oh, I know what it is, but why did she pick it up?
I think she's known it was there. So, like, okay. Is there a scene where Salvor takes her leather jacket and, like, has, like, a flash of recognition or something? That's what I'm looking for. It's like...
I don't know. They're flashing back to it in this episode, but I don't remember the scene at all.
Gale was supposed to hide it where no one would find it. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's something, because you're absolutely right. Either Gale was able to mind blast it to her somehow, or she just realized because they're playing a little bit of like, we're not aware of some of the timelines going on. So it's like, I think that mm-hmm. they, if you asked the writers, they'd be like, well, you know, I don't know. Like I said, last episode, if you watch it, she could have like put on the leather jacket and have a funny, like she just felt it, you know, in her back or at her side or something. That's what I assumed. That like if we went back and watched it again,
make her pick it up, but not realize she's picking up the Prime Radiant.
I think Gale went and hid it in her jacket, and then like there's sometimes Salvor between now and then has realized it's there and hasn't said anything, of course. So it's like, I don't think that's too much to ask an audience to surmise.
Gale hid it in her jacket. Okay.
Yes. Because she didn't have it on when she was walking around patrolling for Hugo, right? She was just wearing her, like, tank top.
Oh, I don't remember. But, I mean, they definitely, like, make the connection with the jacket, but I wasn't mm-hmm. sure exactly how that connected. Okay, let's say it was in her jacket. Lining.
Yeah, it's in her jacket.
Yeah, so she realized she has it. She used it to transfer her mind over to the vault, and she says only a couple words to Harry, and he deduces like every single thing we found out about the Prime Radiant and the copies of Harry this season. And she says Gale is in danger and asks for Harry's help.
I really like that scene where they show him like speaking to himself, going off into infinity with the reflective glass. I don't know if they did it optically or if they actually did it in post, but it looked really cool. And then like Salvor, like a ghost, appears in front of him, like into infinity, having the argument. I thought that was really cool. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have it. You said it wryly, like, oh, he just guesses. But I'm like, this could be a tiresome scene for a watcher because we already know this. We're watching Harry. Sure. And a two for one, you don't stress our patience, and you make Harry look like the really smart guy that he is.
Well, I think it's almost played for comedy. It's how little she says and how much he deduces, I think it's played for comedic effect, and it worked for me.
Cause I thought, because like it's still Harry.
Like she's she's specifically trying not to say things, and that's right. Cluing him in to other things that he's, you know, right. deducing. I thought it was really good. Yeah,
yeah. No, I thought it was pretty funny too. Not funny, but I thought it was well done.
We wondered, you know, what the fate of Salvor was going to be. Obviously, the Sighted, when we hear Josiah say, like, Sighted don't kill Sighted, we can deduce that they just pulled her out and of the pool, turned off her mind, pulled her out, put her in this prison.
Yeah. They're really rolling hard with the Doc Brown principle, where it's like, we want our authority figures to be no knowledge of the future is going to contaminate the time stream, but we also want them to have the cheeky little, you know what, fuck it, I scotch taped the letter back together and I wore a bulletproof vest, why not? You know,
what can it hurt?
Now it is a little bit trickier on a show where the whole show is about that thing, to like do that and not fuck with the story that you're trying to tell, but we're early enough that I'm unclear of what side the show's going to end up on different things. So it's like, I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun, but yeah, Harry being like, don't tell me anymore, it's going to mess up the math. And then, fuck the math by the end of the episode.
Yeah, totally. I'm the left hand. I think that's a hilarious line when he's realizing how unimportant he is.
Because he kept briefly gets excited of like, oh my god, maybe I'm the if I don't know it, I'm the left hand.
Yep, it's a great line and it's a great reading by Jared Harris. Yeah.
And it's exactly how Harry would feel, like his ego took a hit there.
He takes no satisfaction in knowing there's a version of him out there that is the right hand. He just wants to be the right hand himself.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder if the power struggle between them is something intentional.
Right.
That like, I need to light a fire in the original foundation, so making them feel like they're the second banana is going to do that. I mean, it's a wheel, like I said, wheels within wheels here.
Mm-hmm. And I want to see both how much is part of the plan and how resilient the plan, or I guess psychohistory, is to changes, deviations from that plan. Mm-hmm. So this kind of stuff excites me, where Harry finds out information he's maybe not supposed to have, or maybe supposed to have.
Right.
At a certain time, and how he reacts to that.
And there's also overall, I keep on thinking back to that this has already drifted and deviated quite a bit. You know, like we are, 173, 168 years behind schedule for the second foundation?
Yeah. Yeah, it has not happened yet.
And some of the stuff to tell him, the Bond, says later really blew my mind too, but we'll get to that, because there's, like I said, the show feels like it's throwing its own monkey wrenches into its own works at some of this stuff, and it's like they gotta have this all figured out.
there's a icky sadness that comes with some of Josiah's lines. He's talking about Harry, you know, he's saying Sighted don't kill Sighted. A, ask the founders in DS9 how that worked out for them. B, when he says Harry was insufficient, I'm like, no, he wasn't. You're just assholes. He's being brainwashed.
Also a little commentary, I think, on able-bodied people and like how we, even if you take great pains or not, you see them as like, they're kind of, you can kind of accommodate this, you got to do that. And stuff that they did in like old science fiction, and it continues to be, they're empathy engines. It's like, how would you feel as a perfectly sufficient person in your own senses and everything if someone comes back because you're missing one that they have? You're like, oh, geez, you're like, poof, is it even worth living? I think they're playing around a little bit with that.
Oh, yeah. It's just sad to hear it out of the mouth of someone who's so clearly been told, so young and so vulnerable, and clearly been told that by somebody else. It's not their own opinion.
Yeah.
Let's go over to Hober and Constant dropping out of warp just outside of the Imperial enclosure around Terminus. They go dark to avoid detection. That's just a quick scene there.
Yeah, I'm glad I wasn't sure what an enclosure, but Hober says, oh, it's an Imperial enclosure. I thought he was talking about a specific type of starship. Like, is this like a super carrier that's supposed to help? But no, you're right. They were just talking about this is a blockade that they put around.
Yeah.
Terminus.
Yep. So I assume that none of the the people of Foundation can escape. We'll see. The director of Terminus is worried about his daughter, Constant. He goes out to the vault to kind of vent at Harry and kind of just worry aloud. Harry appears to him, and that's when he really starts venting at Harry. Harry explains that he does care about people through psychohistory and says that they just have to wait and see if Constant survived.
This is kind of another side of Tell 'em Bond speech. Like, oh, I do feel all the, like, you know, Harry does say, I do see all the individuals.
Yeah.
It's
at a remove.
Just like Tell 'em's, like, well, are you, or are you just desensitizing yourself to trauma? I kind of like, do you, yeah. Harry? I don't know. I did think it's interesting that the, you know, this is Constance's father. He's worried about his daughter's survival. He has taken no solace from their faith because I think his husband says the prophet protects and he just openly scoffs. He's drinking heavily. He's drunk. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the guy that's going to be treating with the emperor. Very interesting, the energy he's taking into this.
I feel like there's something about faith in here, too. Because this guy brushes up against the faith part of the Foundation, but never kind of crosses that line. Whereas you see Polly doing, not the opposite, but a far more potent version of faith, right? Where he believes in Harry unshakably, regardless. This guy struggles with it very much. And I like kind of the lead-ins they're doing to this religious angle of the Foundation here. And the discussion that Polly's going to have with Day here in a bit, I think, like, really leans into that and raises some questions about the future of Foundation.
Well, we've said it a million times this podcast, fake it till you make it in terms of personal development. Like, if you want to be a different person, like, it's psychologically proved that if you just act like that person, pretend like that person, you'll eventually become that person. Mm-hmm. In your actions, your mannerisms, all that kind of thing. And they're, you know, and I believe this. It's like, if you pretend to be a religion long enough, more and more people around you will forget the fact that it's an act. And you can see, like, but the administrator is one of those, you can see that, you can, like you said with Polly, that the crew, like, he is a rationalist. He understands that this stuff isn't magic and Harry's not a god. But when he gets caught up, that line gets pretty blurry where the administrator is clearly on, like, oh, God, Constant, whatever you do, don't join up with those, the mendicants. Like, that sounds like it's got lying dishonesty based into it. It's like, I didn't want her to be one of Harry's dupes. And we know from Polly that she is the dupiest of the dupes because she's just got unvarnished faith in the prophet. That must gall him at some level. So,
yeah.
He's going to take a lot of sacrificial daughter energy into his meeting with the emperor, and I bet it doesn't do the situation much good.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how in a time of need here, he's turning toward Harry the god, you know? And it's partially anger, but you see that all the time, like in stories from the Bible, right? Very often times devoted... people who are strongly devoted to God will go to him and say, why are you doing this? It does not feel good. It feels wrong. Question, you know, the happenings in their life. And here, that's what he's doing. And it's a weird turn to faith for him because he has nothing left to lean on here.
Absolutely. Do you want experts in arguing and wrestling with God? The Jewish people got the championship belt. You know, just go. That's half of the Old Testament's all about. Sure. And it's interesting that this guy who doesn't give a shit about religion finds a concept offensive, nevertheless is going to the holy places and seeking out God, like you said.
Yeah. And it might be argumentative, but it's still a seeking for something beyond.
You don't argue with something science. You don't believe in, Jim.
True. Very true. And then we get a quick scene here about Constant telling Hober how much Polly meant to her. And it's touching. But I don't have a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
There are a lot more interesting scenes happening.
Yeah, it's like it's just a nice scene between Hober and Constance, and a life philosophy where she's feeling bad about Polly because, you know, it's interesting. It's like he was this like pillar of the church, and now she's known him in his decline where he's become a drug addict and alcoholic. And, you know, she sees that as a sad thing, but Hober's like, well, he's poured himself out and he's got nothing left. And he's towards the end of his life. That's kind of where you want to be, right?
Sure. Now her dad's headed down that same path. We'll see where that leads him.
But he was a shitty student at the church, so what does he know?
Yeah. So then we get to another really good scene where Day talks with Polly about Harry Seldon's religion. Polly claims it's just the trappings of a religion because it's all backed up by science. But when questioned more about it, Polly's claims of faith reveal it to actually be a religion. So there's a lot to talk about here. I want to stick with the religious angle really quick. There's an intentional direction toward religion that Harry is creating here. He's trying to establish himself as a god. And I think one of the things that goes unsaid but very much implicated in this scene is, or implied in this scene, is what happens once you create that unshakable faith? What happens once you install yourself as a god? How do you get past that? Or are you looking to a future beyond religion for foundation? And if so, can you forsake your people enough that they will no longer consider you a god? Can you give them something else to worship? What is Harry's ultimate goal here? Is it just to establish himself as a god? Because that doesn't seem like a place that humanity ends up 10,000 years from now all happy.
How do you wean people off of fanatic religion?
Right.
What's the methadone for that?
I think it's a super interesting question, and yeah. I have some ideas, but we'll see how it goes. And you know, this is all... there's a... I guess another question here where Day brings up the topic of his own ignorance and whether... You know, Harry presupposed everyone's ignorance about his plan in the plan, and how does that break the plan? But I'm not so sure that that's a solid thing to lean on, because if you look at the way that Harry has operated, initially he presupposed Empire's knowledge of his plan, right? He went to them and said, "This is all going to fall. Here's the proof." And he kind of said, "You need to know this," and that is part of the plan.
And I don't know if maybe some of the people in the audience don't realize this too, but you're supposed to understand that Harry's already walking the plan of psychohistory years before he gets to the Emperor with Gale, like selecting Gale, all this stuff was him. So like, just when, you know, he was talking to Gale about, you know, the odds like that we could have been executed or this or that, there's still small chances. But like him going and revealing himself to the Empire. Yeah, that meant he no longer presupposed you're ignorant, because he saw the potentialities of that event and he thought it was to his favor. So like, widespread knowledge of the exact plan of psychohistory would probably be destructive, but just saying, you know, like Day just doesn't understand, you know, it's one of those things where like he's never tried, like it's one of those people that's like, you know, like done their own research, but their research is essentially going to Google and be like, why is what I believe the right thing? Oh, I didn't like that. And that's the kind of like when he says, I've studied the foundation, I've studied Harry Seldon, I've studied this. You've read your biased imperial archives, which I imagine the propaganda on that would make, you know, Mussolini blush. You haven't really studied shit, man. And this is like his whole thing is like, I know, that means he can't predict shit anymore, right? It smacks of like a person saying like, if you ask a cop if they're a cop, they have to tell you, right?
Sure.
Like, that's not how any of this shit works. And if that's what you think, you should not be talking to cops or the ghost of Harry Seldon, because they're going to run you, dude.
And there's a lot of stuff he says in this scene that seems on the face of it wrong to me. He thinks that, you know, there's no egg strong enough to stand up in the face of a nuke. I think you're wrong. I think that egg is the vault. I think if you nuke the entirety of this planet, scour every single bit of life from it, Harry Seldon will remain standing.
Do you think it'll come to that, though?
I doubt it, but
yeah, I don't think so either.
We'll see.
It'd be funny.
I just think he's making assumptions that are wrong.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And it's chilling at the end where Polly says, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. And the way Lee Pace just kind of stares right at him and says, you're probably right about that. It's extremely ominous.
Mm-hmm. I also think there's something that the egg may be not necessarily the foundation on Terminus, but the religion that Harry is trying to install. There's a scene earlier where we see the guy over on Savannah who was trying to attack, leading the attack on Constant. And they're burning books, right? They've found like the Imperial Spy's book stash and they're burning all those things. But he's looking back at it like maybe there was something there. Like he's looking back at it very thoughtfully. And I do wonder if this is not designed, like maybe the destruction of the first foundation of Terminus itself is intended by Harry and it's designed to instill this religion even further in the Outer Reach.
Like, yeah, like
sure,
martyring,
eliminate the seat of our power, but by doing so, you just bolster our message and our
faith. Yeah, you make the idea that much stronger.
Right. He's trying
like
to martyr
what
the foundation.
Says is, what we are underneath it all, it's science. It works. Like, you can't destroy faith in, like, fundamental physical principles of the universe. And we're selling that to people under the guise of religion.
And imagine if Empire does just try and nuke the entire planet and Harry Seldon remains standing. I mean, what kind of message is that? All the might of the Empire is insufficient to destroy the man, let alone his message.
Yeah. And you martyr yourself at an organizational level and the organization still, you know, carries on. That's another strong statement.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Oh, I also, I noticed the name of the ship of the Emperor's Rubicon. That's the river leading to Rome that generals were not allowed to cross. Like, it was considered a de facto act of treason if you bared arms across that river because you were coming to challenge for the Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that we're supposed to understand that Trantor is completely demilitarized? Because, like, if the Empire thinks that they're the only ones with hyperdrive technology, why would they need anything other than a fleet to protect them? Because no one could ever reach their heart before they have to get obliterated by their faster and light ships. So it could be that, like,
true,
it'd be like America finding out that what a country had teleportation technology. It's like, oh, we got the Pacific Atlantic notion and all these aircraft carriers and nothing can get to us. Well, now you can just like bamf yourself inside a missile silo or a nuclear reactor or a Ohio class missile submarine. And it's like, oh, shit, we don't have a complete it completely changes in a single day what we think of in terms of safety and security. Is the Empire having that moment right now? They don't have planetary defenses because why would the hell would they need them?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. It's remarkable to me the sort of laissez-faire attitude the Day has about these whisper ships. It's a remarkable sign of the outmoded technology of Empire.
Yeah.
He should be shitting his pants when he sees these whisper ships with technology they don't even understand, let alone have. Yeah. So I definitely... I think he's underestimating the foundation big time. So Salvor has caught Harry up on her situation. He uses the Radiant to travel to the cave and examine her prison. He says he can defeat the power-canceling discs, using them instead to break the rock walls of her prison. She drops the name Hober Mallow on him, and when he gets back to the vault, we see him write that name on its side as the warden burns. There's some timey-wimey... You know, so time gets slippery in the vault, as they say.
Yeah. So we have been watching Gale and Salvor's story like Memento style. It's slowly been catching up to the main sequence of events.
It seems so, yeah.
How'd you feel about that reveal?
it's cool. It retroactively makes all of it make sense, right? And because it's the question, like, if psychohistory can't predict individuals, how does he know about Hober Mallow? I guess it doesn't totally answer that, because Gale, you know, although she can see the future, right? So she sees a specific person.
Yeah, I think it all fits.
It kind of puts a Band-Aid over that, but I don't even know that I needed it.
Yeah, the best show I've ever seen do something like this is like season one of Westworld, and then they always tried to recreate that, and they never quite could.
Sure.
But like the thing about the Westworld is like there was a lot of signs leading up to the reveal, and then the reveal itself was like one twist beyond what you were already suspecting.
Yeah.
I don't feel like there's any signs at all that we were dealing with two different timelines. Maybe there are if you watch this a second, but like that's the one weakness. It's just like it's a reveal.
I wouldn't bet on that because I've missed some things that
they
were doing
in
the past.
I'm not dogmatically saying I can't believe they pulled this. It's more of like, that's one of the reasons I think rewatching a season would be very rewarding, because I imagine a lot of stuff does pay off. But that's the only thing I cannot think a single time where it felt like those timings were out of place. Or I wonder if there is something that does allow you to synchronize the times if you knew what to look for.
Here's the other thing I'm going to throw out there is they did mention how slippery time is inside the vault. I don't know that it's necessary that the Gale Salvor stuff is happening slightly in the past, and we're learning that. I think
it
could be that it's literally she goes back in time in this encounter with Harry, or Harry's able to go back in time and write that on the thing. Because
interesting,
they specifically mentioned time being slippery here.
Yeah, okay, but boy, that is just the ultimate thing to fix the foundation, because you just wait to hear the news from the future, and you just keep passing it down the telephone. And
this had me thinking, is psychohistory so predictive because it can actually predict people's powers, or can Harry somehow peer into the future via the vault technology?
Damn. I mean, I'm not going to take anything off the table, including gutting psychohistory entirely. But like, that would be the one that'd be shocking if they're like, psychohistory is actually just Harry solving time travel and using that to his advantage. But I don't know. I mean, shit like Interstellar has played with this idea. Arrival. It's big boy science fiction stuff for sure.
Yeah, I do wonder what the ramifications of Harry finding out all this stuff and knowing this, and then putting the left-handed thumb on the scale here is going to be. We're kind of seeing those ramifications real time. It's I guess that's interesting to jump back and know that this is Harry's doing. You know, but not directly. It's like through Gale. So he's kind of letting
Gale interpret.
It's a neat
way for them to dodge the... Because that's one of the questions. Like, well, if individualities are not a big thing with psychohistory, then why Hober Mallow? This wasn't psychohistory. This was...
it was Harry fucking Seldon.
This is the left thumb, yeah.
It's his ego, in a way, you know?
Kind of, yeah.
I'm not gonna be a left hand that doesn't do anything.
But it's fair to point out that Harry knows this about himself. You know, just like and to the extent you're supposed to get parallels between the Kleons and Harry, I think it's instructive the way how imperious Kleon was about, don't lecture me about my own states of mind. I'm very well aware of my flashes of anger and my blah, blah, blah. Harry's even more so. So,
and is he using that information?
Because I got to say, if I had to manipulate a clone myself, I bet I could run circles around that bastard if he didn't know it. Because I know sure. I know all my tricks, all my defenses, all the things I would use to verify something was true. The way, like, it would be, I mean, at least in the early going, I imagine you'd converge as individuals. But like, I could buy that.
Yeah, I think it, you know, puts some wrinkles in the equations, perhaps, that it's Gale kind of passing on this information. How much does he understand and control Gale in this whole scenario? Because she's the one that really leaking this Hober Mallow stuff, right?
Yeah.
Through Salvor.
Well, but How would you, but Gail, it's not like Gail leaked it.
No, she told Salvor, and Salvor told Harry here that Hober Mallow would pierce the Empire's side.
What was the circumstances? What exactly, how is that exactly, refresh my mind, how was that exactly transferred, that information? Was this, how many episodes ago?
To Salvor? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. I don't even know that we saw it, frankly.
Okay.
But I could be wrong about that. Anyway, Constant proposes that she and Hober take the opportunity they have sex. And he agrees, and they do it very efficiently. Extremely efficiently.
Yep, seize the moments. I don't know, there's cool. I liked Hober's boots. He had that kind of like space fleur-de-lis thing. It gave him a very cavalier type of look. And him trying to catch up to where she's at and waddling over to her with his pants around his ankles to try to catch up with the kissing. It's cute. It's cute. Got to take care of the body and the spirit will follow.
Sure. I like the scene. I think it's very funny. It's to what end, I guess, is the question. Are we just trying to establish a deeper connection between Hober and Constant for future trauma that they can both experience? Or
Mule baby.
Is this going to be, yeah, that's where I'm kind of going with
this.
It
is
going
to be the one, Jim. I'm putting I'm doubling down on the mule baby, even though I think there's a better theory in the feedback. I can't interfere. It's a canon event. I got to lose all my internet points on this mule baby theory.
I mean, look, there are ways to connect people deeply that don't involve procreation, and they chose the one that does. So
yeah,
it's on the
but
table.
It's a pretty fucking reliable,
for sure.
Old school,
for sure.
It ain't broke, don't fix it, kind of thing.
All right. Well, I'm going to say officially we're on womb watch here with Constant. We're going to keep an eye on the situation.
All right. Womb watch has begun.
With day off planet, Dusk approaches Rue to resume their previous line of inquiry. I thought he meant the memory stuff. He actually meant the mural stuff, which we'll see later.
Yep.
After the sex, Hober and Constant are going to share a bottle of wine. But they are apprehended by Bell.
The idea that there's like a spotlight going through the window of the spirit and Hober's just there full bare ass naked, just hanging dong, I think is in front of Bell Rios is really funny. Uh-huh. It's the unspoken implication, I think, of that scene.
Yeah. I mean, he tried to cover it up, but I'm sure, yeah, his pics will end up on the internet eventually.
I like their, you know, that they vow always to attend each other's assassinations or executions because it's worked out as dates so far.
Yep. Yep. That was pretty funny. There's a mention, you know, earlier about this Hober Mallow sort of being the rebel that I think it's Glaywin says, like, how's that for a rebel?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's Hober Mallow. Now I think it's interesting how you wonder how loyal Bell is going to be to the Empire in the face of this rebel, right? This ultimate rebel, Hober Mallow. I think he's going to have a lot of sense to talk, and Glaywin's probably going to be cheerleading some of that stuff.
These are people we can work with, and Day is going to be manifestly not. And
well, and Bell is going to be, you know, he's going to be the deciding factor, right? Which way will Bell go? Will he remain loyal to his oath to Empire by the letter of the law, but not in spirit? Will he remain loyal?
It seems like he really likes Hober in a certain way. Like the contrast between him and Day, where it's like maybe Hober doesn't do or say the right things, but his heart's in the right place and he cares about people versus Day, who's very theatrical and regal looking, but he's rotten to the core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very interested in this new development, the proximity of these two characters. So Dusk and Rue go out to the mural. Dusk claims there's a hidden message in it and uses some new chroma to reactivate the old stuff. And a door through the mural opens to a corridor.
What do you think about the robot man in the mural being turned into, like, I don't know, maybe that's just a wall disassembly, but I thought it was interesting that it turns into a skeleton. Which is something I always think of as very human.
I thought of this whole imagery as human. I didn't conceive of it being a robot.
Is there some kind of
mostly because it has a brain, like a very human looking brain, and we
that's
don't
Dimmerzell.
I guess we see that with Dimmerzell, yeah.
It's got all the structures. They're just all chrome, shiny and chrome. I don't know. And there's it's very interesting to hear how Dusk talked about the role. Like he spoke of it as a big tragedy that, and I like how common is this view in the galaxy that these robots that we created, these thinking sensitive beings, and then we betrayed them, and all they wanted was personage. All they wanted is to be considered people, and we didn't give that to them. And the one of them found the way to override the first law of robotics, and then shit was on. That can't be the widespread view of robots of the galaxy. Is that special Cleonic Dynasty knowledge that he's only got because he's walked the walls and he's read the histories? And
yeah, possibly.
I was
that.
Just shocked at how pro robot that take was. Like, we had a good thing going and we fucked it up.
Yeah.
Is that Dimmerzell's influence?
I wonder. Is like, now I'm looking at all of his memories, right? All of his
her
thoughts.
Spin that, like, oh, us robots were persecuted and we only wanted the best for you and you guys just wouldn't have it. And that's what a robot would say now, wouldn't it?
I want to see what drove the first robot to kill the first human it killed. I think that could be, that could illuminate some things. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you had a particularly nasty emperor. Because the first person to die
was
someone checking, was an emperor.
Trying to push 50 items through the 12 item or less checkout lane. They just like, God damn it.
Sure. Yeah.
Humans won't respect anything.
Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to go back to a time when the Empire was younger. I don't know. I'm excited for next episode to see
also,
some Dimmerzell centric stuff.
Is there with the Scooby-Doo nature of this, is there something a little too, is this a little too Zion from the Matrix where this is like an escape valve for this malcontented Dusks to catch them in a trap? Because like it's everything's just so flattering to him. Where he's like, oh, only an old Chroma master. But he's like, you can tell that he's like feeling like he's got his woman at his arm. He is Brandon Fraser in the fucking Mummy, and he is about ready to go. Dun 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 dun. It's too cute, right? Like this has got to.
I mean, this could be specifically. So the thing that keeps nagging me is this freaking mirror, and I know like this is a silo thing, but it's also, you have to remember that everything in the palace is monitored, everything except for, you know, those under those maintenance tunnels or whatever, which are
and
then also monitored.
Master's
right
scrambler, yeah.
And they're talking so openly, Rue and Sereth, about their plans in their chambers, which are controlled by Empire. I have to wonder if this is a Dimmerzell plot to trap Rue down here. They talk about it as a prison.
So
she's got to know that she is what she is plotting with Dusk here about his memories. This could be a trap for her and set specifically by Dimmerzell because she knows what kind of person Dusk is. He's going to notice these things, right?
The thing is, now that I know that they have a scrambler, I just assume that every time we see them talking to private quarters, they have it activated. Although I wish to show had a convention where there was like the way they did, you started the scene with a little bit of a wah-wah to just subtitled until you go inside the bubble, because I feel like that would be a real wah-wah moment if it's like, oh, we had your quarters bugged, you dumbasses, and you came all the way to Trantor to conspire in the room next door. It's like, that doesn't feel super clever. Whereas, like, this thing
but
being
they're talking
like
everywhere, right? I mean, like Dusk and Rue are talking openly next to the mural.
This is
about
true.
This stuff. It's not just in their quarters. So, like, unless it's something physically on her that is causing, you know, some privacy to happen,
But what do you think about my idea of like this is a wayward Dusk trap, that there is like breadcrumbs for the different phases of the Empire that Dimmerzell can kind of shunt them if they're going into dangerous things, and then you know, because I do think if I were Dusk, I would shit myself when Cleon the first came up and be like, oh, you want answers, do you? Like, oh my god, they expected me. Mm-hmm. This is not something that I broke into, and yeah. I'm not, this is
I'm not off the rails, I'm very much on them.
That's what it felt like to me. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It removes all of his own agency, right? It's just
right.
Like revealed
how many other Dusks have bounced up with fresh chroma to this door handle and thought, aha, I've got mm-hmm. the answer. And how many times has this played over the course of Cleonic history?
Yeah, it's possible it's that. I also like the Demerzel, you know, trapping Rue down here angle, because it's kind of what they're trying to do, which is drive wedges between, isolate and drive wedges between the Cleons. She could be doing the same with Sereth. Like, leave Sereth alone on this planet with Empire.
She's all, that, yeah, truly
I
alone.
Mean,
yeah.
Talk about terrifying.
Mm-hmm. But Day's off the planet, and so is she.
She's not off the planet.
Oh, no, she's with Day. They're en route to Trantor. Or, I mean, sorry, Terminus.
No, Dawn and her are banging in the tunnels.
Oh, I thought you said Day. I thought you said that she's still alone here. So I don't think she's terrified to be alone with Dawn, do you?
I think she would be terrified to be alone in Empire by herself, just in general.
Hmm.
Certainly a scarier okay. position than having the backup of Rue and whatever that other dude is.
It feels like it's an evenly numbered match now that they got Day out of the picture. So I thought it was like less attention.
Oh, what I'm saying is if this is a plan to trap Rue down there in some prison, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
But yeah, I don't know. We'll see what it's all about. Sereth and Dawn meet in the maintenance tunnels. He tells her he's been thinking about her proposal, and they go into a room to get it on after Dawn reverses his sterility.
He hands her the remanning device. It does look like it hurt, but, you know, nanites are on it.
Let me ask you this. He's
working perfectly
aware...
now, by the way.
Yeah. No, it looked like it really hurt. I wouldn't want to do it.
But isn't
also,
it's significant that now the nanites are working. Like, this would be, from an Empire's perspective, convenient for them not to work, but now they're working perfectly.
Right.
Hmm.
Interesting. Hmm. Does Dawn not know he's being monitored in these tunnels? Didn't Dusk like straight up tell him, I saw you in the tunnels because we have the Shadow Master or whatever down there?
Wait,
he doesn't seem worried about that at all, right?
But those were different tunnels, I think. That was just the underbelly of Trantor versus this is like the heat exchanger, and this is like one place that doesn't have monitors. Or at least that's what they tell the Cleons.
Yeah, I don't know that I buy that. They're using all the same effects. They're using...
Well, at some point, if the show keeps telling us that there's no way to be detected and there's always a way to be detected, then I don't know what you know, that can go to weird, you know, places, the same as having ability to clone people and transfer consciousness and regenerate from death. Like, you can, like, goddamn, at some point I gotta trust the things you're telling me.
Sure. I agree with that from a narrative point of view.
But to your point, if you're asking me, do I think that no one knows what the hell Sereth and Dawn are doing down there? No, I don't think that's true. I think that Demerzel has to have at least some inkling.
Yeah, I would think so. I'm surprised Dawn isn't more worried about that. Also, do the clones get regular physicals? Because surely a physical would reveal the procedure he does here.
I would think that, like, within seconds of doing a body scan in mm-hmm. their royal suites, that they would, yes, see the numerous, that would be a difference that the thing would highlight. Like, oh, your vas deferens is regenerated, huh?
Right. That's not natural.
Oh, it must be a nanite mistake.
Yeah, this seems extraordinarily risky, but he's young and dumb.
Well, the other thing is, like,
horny.
We also know that he could have his memory audited by his elders at a moment's notice. Like, if there's one more, like, in fact, we just had a terrorist plot. They're like, they could maximally suspect everybody all over again, and he would be completely fucked. But I mean, I don't know. There's a level of impetuousness about Day or Dawn that I guess I'd get, but Dusk has it too, because like the last time we saw Dusk, he's like, we can't do anything unless we have leverage. I guess he's trying to find leverage, and he's what he says is, this the best time to go looking for it when Day's gone. All that stuff tracks. But
yeah, for Dawn, I guess it's the best time to get with Serith, but it's still risky.
You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast. So I guess the whole explanation is the fact that Day is gone. That's why it's like, yes, they might be nervous about the memory audits. That's why they've been saying it's so dangerous. But they have a window of opportunity where they think that they can go whole hog. In fact, Dawn is the master of the Empire in terms of Trantor right now. So this is, they are taking a calculated gambit to do a whole bunch of shit that Day hopefully will never find out about while he's away.
Does Dawn have the authority to order his memories restored? Dusk's memories erased?
I mean, when someone says Trantor is yours, I feel like anything that's confined to the planet would be fair game.
I would think so. Yeah, big opportunity. Let's use it.
But on the bigger moves you make, the more chances you've got the archivist like sending a hyperspace signal today to check it. And it's like, so you probably have a little bit of like breaks. It's not all gas. You got to have some breaks.
Sure. No breaks on the rest of this episode, I got to say. Dusk and Rue reach a stairwell and follow it down. We're going to start jumping back and forth here pretty soon.
I like that line about feel like a stranger in my own home. It's like, imagine if you went and you saw there's a room you'd never notice in your basement, and you open it up and there's like a whole other house with evidence of people living there. That would be such a weird feeling.
Yeah, this strikes me as like Barbarian, that movie.
Yes, yes. Like,
I know that's an Airbnb or whatever, but if it were your own house and you discovered that, I would
be terrified. Yeah, like I don't know that there's a feel, but like it makes the hair stand up in the back of your head just to think about it.
For sure. All right, Salvor uses her discs inside her cell to destroy the stone ceiling. Gale wakes to find herself part of a ceremony, and she's told by Telem about how she stole the bodies of various children over the ages, and now she's going to do it to Gale. This is completely fucked, man. I thought I couldn't hate Telem more, and every episode they reveal another wrinkle in her psyche that just makes me despise her a little bit more.
It's also the self-delusions that she's telling herself.
Like,
she's not, I don't think she's facing it at all. I don't think she's facing the awfulness of what she's doing at all. I think she's being pretty cowardly here. And I also really wonder how much she's straight bullshitting too. Because when she starts saying, like, a century ago, I felt you're, that's why you started. And Gale's like, no, wait a second. I was studying mathematics because of it. And I went to do, I solved the Abraxas thing on my, where are you at on that? Do you really believe that all this was set in place by Tellum? Or was it Harry? Was it Gale?
I don't know.
Because, like, if you believe it's Gale, like, because, like, I think you're supposed to believe it's Harry. Harry set all this in motion. It could have been anybody, but it was Gale. And he set the thing in motion. So now Tellum's saying, well, no, actually, I did it. I don't know who to believe. Or if I believe it was just Gale. Or if it's both.
Yeah, because I don't know how much psychohistory accounts for this. I don't know if the Sighted or the Metallics are operating outside of that or not.
Because they're outliers, so like it is possible that they're both correct.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
The other thing I question is how much of what's happening here is necessary and how much of it was meaningless ritual. Like, they do the ribbon cutting ceremony and they tie one to her wrist or tie one to her. They have the tuning mirrors. They have the mini harmonicas. They have the set. Like, how much of this is actually required to do this and how much of it is just like foundation religion? Because I'm always looking for parallels here, you know? How much of it is this just the works part, and how much of it is Polly with fireworks and holograms?
Yeah, I don't know. I assume they don't have to hold hands to make this connection, but that just feels like a power play by...
Yeah, it's
by Tellum.
It's an extra violation.
It's symbolic to the crowd. And stripping of personhood from the victim here, it's... Yeah, it's fucked up. It's entirely, man.
It was chilling. This is an extremely chilling bit of writing. That, like, I heard that little girl for several years, like a voice at the bottom of the well. And then when she, like, puts her hand on Gale's and says, I still listen for her just like I'll listen for you. What the I mean, this is like, what is that, the first Jordan Peele movie? You know, like being down in the deep place.
Oh, Get Out? Yeah.
Get Out. Yes, Get Out. It's like the way that they always envision Kahlua down there, like sunk in the sunken place, right?
Yeah.
And what a horrific experience they portray it. Or I guess another one is like the end of being John Malkovich, which I always found exceptionally chilling too. This idea of just being stuck, like as a passenger in someone else's, in your body.
Yeah, it can't be a good feeling. It has to be torturous. And the thing that really makes me hate Tellum even more about this is the hypocrisy, like, and the lies, just the blatant lying. Like, what is this if not Sighted killing Sighted? What is it if banishing someone to nothingness in their own mind is not killing them? What is it?
Well, her idea was like, well, sure, we're breaking this rule, but as little as possible, because only I get to do it. And it's also,
Obi-Wan Kenobi shit. Like, oh, well, we're not actually killing the Sighted. We're just,
But the other thing it does
taking
is
their mind from them.
It's yet another genetic dynasty. It's yet another eternal vault copy of Harry. It's yet another singular person trying to keep their consciousness going and influencing past a time where they should have died.
Which, let me throw this out there. Tellum's totally the mule, right? I mean, now that we know she can transfer consciousnesses, and I assume this is not going to take with Gale. Like, Salvor's going to bust, like, Kool-Aid Man her way in and disrupt this whole thing, and she'll be looking for another host down the line 130 years from now. 150,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, no, so last week someone called that, like, out of the...
Yeah, I did. I was like, I think Tellum's totally the mule.
Was it because what is a piece of feedback that we read too? I think it was somebody from New York.
Okay. Well, I'm on that theory now, 100%.
But yeah, no, I think that he was thinking of it from you know, like a mental projection angle. But like, no, I don't know who she's going to transfer her body into. But it does seem like the reason she doesn't look like herself is because she's just going to take someone else's body.
I think it's going to be Josiah, which is going to be deeply fucked and sad.
But the blue eyes. No, I think,
well, she's got 150 years to get to the mule body, right?
But those blue eyes are those are thespian eyes. And the thing about that is, like, those are coded to be outer worlds and therefore foundation spaces. And I think if this is all true, you're supposed to, I think the implication is that Telem is going to find a way to worm her way within the organs of the foundation to where she can take over someone with the thespian body. Or I guess she can just call them. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that was my first thought too, is that it's going to be the little kid. But then I was thinking, oh, it's got to actually. But you're right. There's also quite a bit of time. We have time for a body
she can
or
jump
two.
Yeah, several bodies.
Yeah.
But I do think it would be pretty fucked up to take this kid's body to demonstrate, you know, on screen what she has just told us. I think it's one thing to know it. It's another thing to see it. So I don't know, man. Not like and tell him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, she's, like I said, I liked her because I've associated her with positive things from other things I've seen her in. I think she's a very warm, caring grandmother figure. Nope, not anymore. She's just a fucking monster.
She's a versatile actor is what she is. And she's doing a hell of a job making me hate the character.
It's Fred from Newborough, New York. He's the one that sent in the idea that the mule could be Telem. And I think, again, nothing proven, but boy, that theory's got long legs after this week.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back over to Dawn, who says he doesn't want Day raising his child after him and Sereth have just potentially created one. So Sereth suggests they destroy his clones. And he says, well, that'd be tough, and Demerzel would stop it anyway. And Sereth asks, who programmed Demerzel? and Dawn's response is, she always has been. He doesn't say that, but he might as well, right?
This is what I was waiting to talk about, though. Is this evidence that this is something that was removed from Dusk and Day and Dawn doesn't know yet? Because he doesn't say she's all. It's like his memory had, because, like, obviously Goyer's not an idiot. If there was an implication that was a hole, the perfect thing to do is have him run back. It bookends the episode. It'd be perfect. Mm-hmm. That's a deliberate choice not to have him do that. So I just don't think he realizes.
Sure. No, I'm with you. I don't know how to pin down Dawn in this scene. He fell as hard as possible for Sereth here. Like, this conversation about Day rearing his child is about 9 months premature. But it's immediate. Like, he just pulled out of her, and now he's already like, I don't want Day to raise my kid.
Right.
Jesus Christ, man. It would have been nice to know that first. And B, give it some time to think about it.
Yeah. I guess getting Trantor has gone to his head. Like, he's one of those kids that's like, you know, he gets a little, he's just going to fling completely out of control. But is there any implication that they are fucking with their memories? Like, are they going to, like, would you be surprised if, like, deep in episode 9, early in episode 10, that, like, Sereth reveals that in advance of their coming, that they sent the handman there to, like, incept the desire to be with Sereth into Day or Dawn?
I felt like they were telling this story pretty straightforward, but I'm open to the possibility of
there's
being
been so many
way
like
off.
I said, there's been a story of, like, Empire thinking that their technology is going to save them, and, like, they're wrong in every front. They don't have the edge in speed, they don't have the edge in weapons, they don't have the edge in control mechanisms like memory technology and things like that. They can't control their fucking propaganda streams. That ends up being a huge humiliation for them. Nothing is just working the way it should. So, like, the idea, if you carry the memory, that's, like, one of the reasons that the Empire has been able to be unbroken. They have, you know, the ultimate control over what people think. If that's no longer true, because it is a bit, I mean, Dawn's always been a little bit of romantic, though, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we saw what happened last season with him and the,
like, if you can make him think that you care for him as an individual, like, that's all he wants, man. So maybe they just know how
he wants to live
Klingons
a life,
are wired.
Right? Yeah. Like Dusk says, young men, they want to live a life.
Or I wonder, the other thing is, like, what if Cloud Dominion has for decades been quietly collecting ex Gossamer Court participants and reclaiming their memories so they can build like a personality portfolio of all the Kleons and know exactly what buttons to push. That's not what well, that only makes sense.
Perfect clones. I feel like these, you know, drifted clones don't work. That doesn't work as well on them.
It also would imply that Cloud Dominion's been trying to undermine Empire since before the assassination, which
yeah,
I would actually believe. I mean, they've been telling the story of the whole galaxy trying to nibble.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying it could be an interesting reveal of like, we've actually been planning for decades. Your assassination just accelerated the plan or something.
I find it hard to believe that Demerzel would not know what's going on here. If Rue can take one look at Sarith giving eyes to Dawn during a ceremony or whatever and realize that she's crossing lines with him, Demerzel could do the same, right?
Unless you can't because she's a robot. That'd be the only...
Possibly.
Because she has 13,000 years of experience.
Yeah.
But if she just like can't get subtleties of human emotion, I do find that hard to believe, though.
Me too. So I'm wondering if there isn't a reveal here that Demerzel is letting certain things happen, is guiding, kind of guiding everybody's hand here behind the scenes.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to work out, but that's the story they're telling, is that Demerzel is controlling everything. If they subvert it now, it'd have to be a doozy.
So the question becomes like, what is the reason for Demerzel letting this happen? She's letting Dawn hook up with Sarith.
Well, that's the thing is, like, I don't think she liked the all the looks on her face from the time Day says I'm taking out and I'm going to Terminus is her having a robotic cow. She is glowering at the galaxy. She is got this like weird face. She's making these weird concerned faces. And also, like, these seasons seem to be kind of rhythmic, right? Like, around this point of last season, Day was going to walk the spiral. Now Day's leaving Trantor again. And, like, everything kind of, like, put maximum pressure on Demerzel towards the end of last season. I wonder if this is where she starts seeing, like, shit, I'm going to have to probably decant three of these fuckers, if not all three of them. And we know that that's not something that she does cost-free. Like, killing a Kleon hurts her. So it could be just that she's like, yeah, this is, I don't like this. But also I can't interfere like this blatantly. I don't know what she's thinking.
Certainly interesting.
Guess we'll have to find out next week.
Yeah. So there's a quick sequence at the end here, which kind of brings everything together. It's a Day going down to Terminus. Or preparing to, I guess. Dusk finding a copy of Kleon the First that welcomes him to a prison, and Dawn realizing that the clones are just puppets, and Demerzel is Kleon's true heir, his forever empress. Or perhaps the last empress, as is the title of this episode.
Yeah. I noticed that I don't know if this is something intentionally, but they kept on zooming in on Demerzel's face, and I noticed in her, you could see reflections in her eyes, and there was like three bars. That could just be like the way the window was lining up she's looking out of, but like if they're trying to tell something about what's important to her, and again, I don't know if this is a Galadriel situation where it's like Peter Jackson strung up all the Christmas lights to make it look like she's shining, or if this is just an accident of the set, but like I thought it was significant that as you pan out and they're wondering like, you know, what is important to her, you've got this three kind of like bars in her eye
representing the three laws.
Ooh, fuck, I was going with the Kleons, but do have three of them sums of bitches with their laws too, don't they?
It's true. But we know she's been reprogrammed. Who reprogrammed her? That's also a good question.
What many things can a chamber be? Like, this chamber has been many things over the years, but at first it was a prison. So, okay, she's the last imprisoned robot. Then what's the next thing the room becomes? A garage? a workshop,
sure. Storage room,
a
your kids move
room.
Out, you know, you leave it the same for a while, but then it becomes your office.
Right, right.
Or, I don't know, a sex room. I'm sure.
That's what Dust means. He's just like, oh my God, a place in the castle I've never fucked in.
Right?
Call up the Gosper Corps. We need three more people. I don't know. I just wondered, like, yeah, what all, and now, and why does Dimmerzell not, why, she's taking great lengths to hide this, but also a visual clue. So, like,
yeah,
why? Why not just destroy this?
Dawn, or Dusk down here, I think.
Why not fill this with, you know, Duracrete or whatever the science fiction material they would call it is? Like, why leave it? What is important about this chamber? That none of the emperors can know about it, and yet it's important for enough for. Is this where distributed consciousness lives?
I was wondering. Yeah, could be that.
Ooh.
It could be this is where a true remaining copy of Cleon the First exists. Maybe there is no drift in this version of him. I don't know.
So that would imply
it seems just like a memory recreation, like the other
Dimmerzell's allowing the. I wonder if, like, you're going to find out that Cleon discovered psychohistory, or because, you know, the one thing they play with psychohistory is like, well, if Harry hadn't invented it, somebody would have. What if the Emperor had independently arrived at it hundreds of years before and was started, did the Cleonic dynasty with Dimmerzell running it as a deliberate attempt to not go through with that? Wouldn't that be interesting if he's got like a primitive version that's not quite correct?
I don't know, man. The possibilities here are endless.
Yeah.
I just really want to see the next episode.
All right. Well, do you have anything else you want to talk about in this episode?
I don't think so.
If you'd like to send us feedback, it's really easy to do so. foundation@baldmove.com. All right, first email is Patty. Says, there's been some discussion about why the Vault asked for an individual in Hober Mallow, and you're both speculating the Vault Harry must know who is on Terminus at the time. Like, he has some sort of register, and if it wasn't Hobor, it would be someone else, so it's not really about psychohistory needing an individual. I think, though, you might have forgotten that this only happens after the other Harry hears Gale recount her vision of the mule, which specifically references Hober Mallow. It's interesting. So this came like literally an hour after we recorded the last podcast. Patty got this like 2-3 weeks ago. So
nice.
Patty, like Polly before him, really connected with Harry and what he's doing with Prime Radiant. Al Chalant says, a few days after watching last week's episode, this has begun to sink in. Is Harry maybe disguising a personal revenge plot on Empire with a psychohistory plan? The way he's always been so obsessed with the plan lends to this. It's a bit of fun to question. The plan to save the universe may be influenced by some not so noble intentions. How much of psychohistory is Harry genuinely trying to help the galaxy, and how much of it is him trying to stick it to the Empire, who he blames for killing his wife?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question after seeing the episode with Yana. I couldn't tell you, but I'm sure it's not 100% pure in either direction.
My take is anyone could have invented psychohistory. When the potential, when it turned to become Harry, is when his wife died. Because I don't think Harry, with his wife alive, finds the courage of convictions to dedicate himself the way he has to psychohistory. So it's like...
So Harry himself being part of psychohistory...
Could
have
been one of millions of people working on this, but he's the one that was galvanized at the right time, the right place, with the right tweak from the Emperor to make him committed.
Yep, that makes sense.
Eric in Portland says, during Harry's flashback to university when he's arguing the Proctor, she said that we're all Empire. Do you think Dimmerzell has a similar definition of Empire? So this is like a Bell Riosian read where Empire is the people rather than the Lee Pace. Which do you think Dimmerzell
favors?
Yeah,
I think Empire is Cleon the First in Dimmerzell's mind.
My favored approach is that Dimmerzell sees the Empire as humanity and the best way to save or advance humanity.
Interesting.
Because I've always thought it interesting that no matter who asks, whether it's the other Cleon, she steadfastly says, I am loyal to Empire. which is the neatest way to ever dodge a question of loyalty. Because it's like, well, fuck, man.
Sure.
Depending on how you define empire.
Yeah, it lets the person on the other end of that define it for themselves. I don't know. In my mind, her definition of empire is Cleon the First, but we'll see.
Dominic says, Dimmerzell shifting from three laws to one has some implications. For instance, was that what started the robot war? Hearing something like robot war when you know that one of the three laws was to not harm humans implies something changed for the war to happen. Which we got confirmation this episode. We don't know why or what, but we do know that's the first shot in the war. Were the three laws of robots changed to one law, and was that law something like kill all humans? Was Cleon able to save Dimmerzell for his own plans because it was discovered that one could change the one law, and that law was changed to serve Empire? What do you think? I don't like the ones for one of it, like that, oh, the robots to win the war rewrote their laws with one war, with one law, kill all humans, the Empire is able to subvert by be loyal to Empire. Like, I feel like Dimmerzell's more like could be many different overlapping laws.
It's possible. But I mean, it's self-evident that you, at some point, all the robots had to be overwritten with new laws because they wouldn't fight humanity otherwise, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what the circumstances leading to breaking that law in the first place, the first law, were. That's the most interesting thing to me about this. Because we see how Dimmerzell acts. We know that she has overwritten those laws. Like, otherwise, she couldn't snap Dawn's neck, right? Like, and she herself says, like, I only follow one law now. It's Empire.
And Zephyr Hylima saying that cost her a lot, killing someone for on the orders of another human, no less. It could be an implication that these laws are so hard to change that, like, the Empire is only able to institute one in its place, which is loyalty for the Empire.
Yeah, that doesn't...
Also, Dusk said something interesting, that not only did human fight robot, but robot fought robot, implying that there were loyalist robots that even after all the bullshit still stayed true to their loyalty to humanity. Is Dimmerzell from that side or the antagonist side?
That's a fair question. We don't really know. The thing that's striking me about this, and we know how Foundation kind of loves its thematic consistency and transferring that to different characters, the idea of like the Cleonic dynasty being degraded and falling apart could be a way that they go with these robot laws as well. They were corrupted somehow. What's the corrupting influence here? Well, it's genetics in the Cleons, it's the laws in the robots. I wonder how much they're going to lean into those thematic similarities.
I mean, it seems like they're leaning into a lot of these, like copying themselves. So it's like, yeah, it seems like there's a lot of kind of fractal.
They like those
storytelling
echoes.
Here. Yeah. I do too. No, it's super. If you can pull it off, it's super rich. No matter level, zoom or remove, it always kind of telling the same story. Alan asks, from a strictly Darwinian selfish gene perspective, should it not matter to Dawn or Day which of them fertilizes the queen's eggs unless there's some significant genetic drift between just the two of them in one generation? Well, we know that's the case. Like,
true.
We opened the season with Day not being able to instinctually be in sync and having to learn those things by rote and talk about the extensive genetic damage that they repaired, which... Like, okay, well, if the extensive damage was repaired, is there minor? Are there still minor differences? And they're all obsessed with individuating now. So, like, yeah, I think it matters. Even if they're 99.9% identical, I do think it matters today. And like he said this episode, you didn't have the benefit of watching this, of course. But, like, there's a lot of nature versus nurture. I don't want this asshole, even if it's my genes, I don't want him spreading his crazy reactionary bullshit to my kid.
Sure. Yeah, I'm with you. I think he would be offended by that, regardless of their genetic similarity.
Yeah. Matt from Alberta says, the answer to how Empire knows that 10% of the spacer population is the same answer it always is in Foundation, math.
the spacers really need a spice, then presumably there is a recommended dosage. The spacers ask for enough spice to sustain, say, 50,000 individuals. The Empire sets the tithe at 5,000. The population goes up, then a requested delivery goes up, and the tithe does too. I'm sure they could mess with the numbers somehow, but when you're delivering essential supplies, much can be gleaned from the amount used over a specific time period. Yeah, this is true. That's a perfect explanation. They could probably juke the stats a bit to hide, you know, a couple hundred individuals here and there, but nothing that would make them able to rebel against the Empire at scale. Like, they couldn't just save up, like, 100 years worth or whatever.
Sure.
Although, could they? Like, if they decided to... That's what I'm saying. Like, if they're just self-reporting...
Have two sets of books.
Or if the species just like, okay, half of us are gonna voluntarily commit suicide so we can stockpile a year's supply for the other half to fight for a war of independence.
I mean, they have to trust that they can discover a way to manufacture their own opalisk in the meantime.
Yeah.
Otherwise they're killing themselves.
Did you realize that that's what Bel Rios was mining at the slave facility?
Not until I heard Goyer talk about it on the podcast. That's one of the things that I missed, yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice little connection that circle of bondage. Jin from North Virginia says, this is a whole take on that Bhagavad Gita thing. Those books that the Imperial informer showed the Glawan. She had some extra commentary. She goes on and explains it, which we talked about that in the feedback a couple weeks ago. But it's basically you have this prince, Arjuna. He gets into debate before this big battle with this deity, Krishna, who pauses time at the precipice of battle, and they debate the justness of the situation. And eventually Krishna convinces Arjuna that your role is that of a warrior and you have a sacred duty. Your dharma is to be a warrior, and you have this role that you're duty-bound to play. So... Jin continues and says, what I find intriguing is that this Gita addresses themes that the whole show is touching on. How much free will does any one of us have? How much are we just caught up in the flow of events? I find that Harry Seldon is kind of proselytizing what Krishna is getting at in the Gita, a long arc of history that what is and individual humans don't have much of an impact on it. I don't know how much I believe that, but as someone who has studied the Gita a bit, I find an interesting parallel with the show. Hinduism is the third largest religion in 2023 at a time when the top one, Christianity, is on the decline. It would make sense that a future humanity would be heavily influenced by something like the Gita. As a side note, I was curious if Asimov had ever read or admired the book. I couldn't find anything, so maybe the conceit of it, the TV show writers, but Eastern philosophy was popular in the 50s and 60s among nerdy academic types, so my guess is that he must have. Probably. I think it's interesting you talk about the religions of the future. That's something that, like, over the course of like hundreds of years, no one knows what the hell is going to come out of this, like, increasing secularosity, the all the upheaval we probably got ahead in the next century or so. We have, like, I think it's interesting to see what kind of religious blends come out. Christianity itself was like a syncretized religion, like based on, you know, coming out of the Judaism. So it's like, yeah, like what kind of weird hybrid of like Muslim Christianity and Hindu will come out in the 24th century? Who knows? But it's fascinating to think about.
I thought it was going to be the Mormons, but I don't know.
Well, that's what the dystopia future that The Expanse holds out for us, that the Mormons are going to be the one to colonize the galaxy. Good
they
or
would
bad.
Have till Miller blew up their ship.
It depends on how you feel about that South Park episode. That's true. Miller single-handedly reset everyone's religion back to the same starting point for colonizing the galaxy. Anyway, back to the Gita. We have this last conversation with Glawan and Bel in episode 7, where it's pretty clear that they defected a foundation if they thought it would do any good. Glawan's ready to do it right then and appears to be taking Arjun's place in the Gita, which essentially, this seems wrong, let's get out of here. Meanwhile, Bel has the longer view, like Krishna, where he's saying, if we take down the Empire, it's going to be so much worse. This is our role in this battle and we have to let it play out. To put it in language of the Gita, Bel believes that his dharma, his duty, that is life,
is to do what he has to do to minimize the harm to the extent that's possible. In Bell's mind, if he wasn't leading the battalion, someone else would be, and perhaps he can do it in a way to minimize harm. As Christian would say, if that's your dharma, you do that, and you can faithfully do it knowing that you're not offending God. We can infer that a large moral stain of fighting wars is on those who actually do have the power, i.e. the emperor. When the Gita first showed up in the show, I didn't think much about it. Now I think it's a clever roadmap to where these two characters will end up. It makes me think that no matter how hard I want them to defect to the Foundation, that's not where Bell is going to do the most good. But the writers could subvert that, I suppose. Yeah, I don't know. Is it possible that he would see his dharma as protecting the Empire, and if the thing that's most in his way of doing that is Empire himself, that he should be Empire?
Possibly. I could see that interpretation. I also wonder, you know, what kind of justifications he's going to do in terms of his dharma. Like, the next time he's given an order that he knows if he refuses, he will be, you know, pulled off, executed, and someone else will take his place if he's willing to just follow the orders blindly of Emperor, saying, well, I'll do better in the future.
There's one other...
So many ways to think about that.
There's one other interesting facet Jin had here, which is Harry's name. She said she didn't clock that it was spelled H-A-R-I, which is very much like the Hindu word Hari, which means in Sanskrit, one who takes away sins, one who removes delusion, or one who shines a light into darkness, which obviously be very easy to see Harry seeing himself as that way. This also is a this Hari is also a synonym of Vishnu, which of the three Hindu deities is the one responsible for creation and shaping of the universe. If it wasn't spelled that name on purpose, going back to maybe Asimov's fascination with Eastern religions, what a coincidence, huh?
Sure.
All right, that does it for feedback this week. Once again, that's foundationofbaldmove.com to get a chance to get your question read. Make sure you put in the subject line the words Goyer, G-O-Y-E-R. If you have a question for the man himself, that'll make it easier for me to find in the weeks from now when we're having that conversation. Otherwise, if you'd like to find out what other things we're doing at Bald Move, follow us on social media. We're at Bald Move pretty much everywhere except for TikTok. We're Baldest Move, at Baldest Move there. And finally, you can support what we're doing here at Bald Move. Get ad-free feeds and tons of bonus audio video content by going to support.baldmove.com. That's going to do it for us this week. Cannot wait to see the Dimmer Cell Heavy episode 9. Until then, I'm your host Aaron,
and I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy this podcast.